This is Hidden Killers Half Year in Review. A look back at some of the most compelling cases of 2026 so far. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Let's move over to another case that continues to develop. People tried to warn them. Anna Kempner's ex-boyfriend's family says they told her parents something was wrong with the stepbrother, that he was fixated on her, that there was a disturbing incident. And they allege that they were dismissed. Anna's own aunt says she didn't want to go on that cruise. Now Anna is dead. The stepbrother is charged as an adult with first-degree murder and aggravated S abuse. And prosecutors are telling a judge he did this without any warning, that it doesn't add up. And what it reveals about this family, the suspect, and the investigation matters. Joining me to discuss, retired FBI special agents Jennifer Coffendaffer and Robin Drake. Let's start here, Jen. Prosecutors wrote that Timothy Hudson, this is the stepbrother, the 16-year-old, carried out these crimes without any warning. And I'm finding this verbiage interesting in this document, that it was carried out without any warning and despite an apparent supportive family environment. Apparent, I think, is the word that's doing the heavy lifting in here, being what they're portraying. But the ex-boyfriend's father publicly claims, and so does the ex-boyfriend, that he tried to warn the parents and was dismissed. And Anna's aunt says that Anna didn't even want to go on the cruise. Why are prosecutors using that sort of language when the public reporting suggest warning signs were actually there and it wasn't just something that came out without any warning?
You know, I find it interesting too. And I think part of it might be because they have had the luxury of having interviews done and that they are feeling bad for these parents in a way. There's a certain human factor that goes into all cases as a prosecutor and as an agent. And even though we're supposed to have a lens that doesn't take into any personal, you know, feelings, sometimes the boundary is crossed. And I'm just wondering here if this prosecutor or prosecution team doesn't have some sort of sentiment of belief toward the parents. In other words, that's where it has to be coming from, right? It has to be coming from them and that they're believing me. For this person, right?
Yeah, and those word modifiers to me just are trying to sow a narrative of doubt, you know, for when it does go to trial if they don't plead out. So because anytime you see word modifiers before something, I immediately perk up. And this case so far, the statements we're seeing, lots of word modifiers.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, and especially, I mean, this is a case that has a lot of red flags with the parents. I'm sorry, not that they, you know, murdered her or anything like that, but ignored warning signs. This isn't a case where it does appear to be apparent that there's tons of them, and I get, you know, everybody's human. There's going to be a human element that comes into things. But to overtly add those, I guess, maybe, and I don't know. I mean, somebody's not seeing the full picture here. Or maybe they're seeing a fuller picture than we are. And maybe this is. I mean, it's essentially kind of almost stating it like the Asa Elrup defense of Heuermann, of like, it's right in front of you all this time. There are warning signs, but you're choosing not to see them, which, you know, can be true in a lot of cases if you are choosing not to see them. Not that you're intentionally making that choice, but you are just so on your straight and narrow of what you believe is, and the blinders are on, and you want to make this blended family work, that, well, kids are complaining. Ah, kids complain. It is what it is. I'm wondering if there's a lot of that going on, and the true gravity of these complaints, these issues, are only being understood far after the fact.
Well, you know, the perfect example of this, the egregiousness of sort of whatever, ostrich with their head in the sand and not going to get charged, is Jennifer Soda with Madeline Soda.
Mm-hmm. Oh, still, yeah. That case, that's still the most heartbreaking case of all times. So, I mean, we're coming parallel on these, but yeah, Missy Soda, that is one of the greatest travesties. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I agree with you. I mean, I'm still befuddled that he didn't get the death penalty. I'm befuddled that they pled. I know it's water under the bridge, but we're seeing the same sort of, you know, you can play Sergeant Schultz, which I realize many people in my audience had no idea who I was talking about. That's from Hogan's Hero.
Hogan's Heroes.
Stands there, whatever happens.
I see nothing.
Nothing. And that's believed. And, you know, I think the parents dismissed certainly the warning signs, but to say they didn't know them is garbage.
Yeah. And the thing that really, once this, you know, I guess I'm being a little too positive on some of these cases these days, or trying to, you know, give reasonableness.
Giving grace.
Yeah. Giving grace when I shouldn't, because this is another one. And here's the question, Jen. Have you ever seen a case where you have a S assault as part of the murder, like we now discovered in this one, that went from 0 to 100? In other words, it was accidental. It was an offshoot. No. To me, it's always an escalation that there's a lot of signs along the way on that. Or am I off on that?
I see what you're saying. So you're saying just the fact that there wasn't an essay first, say in another, or in an attempt, and then all of a sudden you leap straight from essay to murder.
No, in other words, because there was an essay here as well as murder, it wasn't from 0 to 100. In other words, there was an escalation that would have been noticed.
Yeah. Look, just the fact when I'm picturing this in my mind, right? She's at dinner. She doesn't feel well. She wants to retire to the cabin. And if I look up and see the brother who I already know, you know, there's information, go, oh, you know what? I think I'm going to go on a walk, you know, or whatever. I'm just picturing all this transpire that night and him follow her into that cabin, and just how terrified she must have been, and how the parents just are probably drinking Cosmos and have no idea, or have an idea, but because they're drinking and having a good time on their cruise, aren't seeing it. Escalation. I don't know. For me, the minute he decided to SA her, to me, he probably decided to murder her, because I think he felt that.
And it's hard to imagine her not sensing that and being exposed to what he's attempting to do, what was in his mind in the weeks and months leading up to this, that were part of those red flags, that she was vocalizing something, a change in behavior, a change in demeanor. Other people are seeing it, because any individual is not going to hide that intent, because you have, especially in a close proximity where everyone's living together, there's a lot of leakage going on between what is going on in here and what you're going to start manifesting physically towards someone if it's going to go into what he eventually wound up being accused of.
Well, he jumped on her, didn't he? And tried to dry hump her one time.
Yeah. I mean, the boyfriend.
And that's only what we know of.
That's what we know of. Yeah. I mean, I'm going to guess that there was other things, but I mean, that in itself is enough to be like, there's a massive red flag. I do not, again, unless it's 100% ostrich. And again, that's a hard one to prove, because some people are ostriches and they fully live their life that way. And you're never going to convince them to live the life any other way. They don't know how. Convince an ostrich not to be an ostrich. Good luck. Some people are the ostrich. If they have this knowledge, why on earth, as a parent, you're in any way, shape, or form considering, why don't you share a bedroom with this person who's attempted to do this to you before? I don't know if it's the stupidity of, if she really thought it was a problem, she would speak up. She would do something, and just kind of pushing the blame onto someone else would be fascinating to see. I mean, not that they're even really having to answer for any of these things. But they should. But I don't know that there's really a legal mechanism where that even comes into play. Being an ignorant parent isn't necessarily a crime.
I think it's going to be really interesting to see what they find on the digital footprint of this, because the boyfriend witnessed something on the FaceTime, as we know, as he has stated. And I wonder what conversation he may or may not had with her after that, because teenagers text a lot. And I really wonder what they're going to be able to pick up on the cross chatter about what was going on from her. And you know, and my message to anyone that is surrounded by potentially creepy people that make you feel uncomfortable in any way, you got to start taking journals, man, because if she had journaled in any way, and maybe she has, maybe we'll find this out, about what was going on, what she's saying, what she's feeling, what people are doing, he's doomed, or whoever did this, again, innocent until proven guilty. But you've really got to document stuff.
Well, and this goes back to what we talked about in Celeste's case, right? In terms of he knew he was going to do this. He does it. Then he knows he's got or feels he has to murder. And then I guarantee he didn't have a plan for afterwards.
No kidding.
There is no possible way he could have lifted her. I'm telling you, it's just impossible to lift her up and throw her overboard. And I bet you anything, that was his initial plan. And then he thought, you know what? I'll just wait until we get docked and I'll find the right time frame. I'll hide her under here. And as soon as we get docked and I find the right time frame, I am going to make sure I manage and get her off and thrown over that night. That's what I think his plan was. And I think, you know, the maid finding her and how things worked out didn't work out well for him.
We're just kind of almost looking at a halfway executed plan and not just utter idiocy, basically.
That's what I think. I think he came up with a plan after she was dead and he was able to execute it because he physically wasn't able to execute it.
Yeah.
In some of the information that's coming out, we see information about some of the digital devices, not just Anna's, but her father, CK is the initials that are being used. So we're going to assume it's probably him that they're looking at everyone's devices in this this circle. If there is information on these devices, and again, big if, I'm not accusing anybody of anything, but if there is information on her, on these devices, of her warning the father of expressing issues here and it being dismissed or something of that nature, could we see charges against dad, against any of the parents here for endangering a minor? I mean, it would be child abuse at a certain point. If your child is coming to you saying, I'm being abused by someone in this home, and you're the parent saying, well, you know, buck up, you know, be you'll get through it. Growing up's tough, whatever BS, you know, is said. Could that be a possibility?
I don't think so. And I think we're already seeing that in the language in the prosecution's documents.
Yeah.
And on top of that, you have a little bit of precedent, I think, for where parents have been held responsible for crimes. And that's the Crumbly case.
Yeah.
And in the Crumbly case, it exuded. I mean, they bought the gun. They let the gun be used by him. They, you know, sent him to training. They did, and they had the message that day, and they knew that he had made these drawings, or at least that the principal had called them about all this, right? So they had, remember there was a text message also that was sent that, oh my gosh, you know, the mother, all of a sudden, the light bulb turns on for her. But nevertheless, you had all these big overt actions, and that led to them being charged. I don't think those are going to exist here.
Yeah, it was a high bar that they set on that one, but they did set it. And I wonder if there's going to start being some leakage as we see more and more of these cases where parents aren't being parents. And I wonder if they're going to start ticking away at that a little bit or not. Because, yeah, you're right. It's a very high bar to meet.
What is the difference here than the Crumblies where they buy their kid the gun? If they're aware that there's a potential S predator in their home, they've been warned by other people, this person is doing this. They were warned by him, again, allegedly, that these sort of warnings were being put out. And let's say they were, for the sake of the conversation. And they continued to basically put the gun in the room with her. But in this case, it's a human being.
I think it's going to have to come down to her. You know, and when you think about these cases that, again, I just keep going back to our cases we're covering of the Duggars and all the cults, unless you actually have the victim themselves say exactly what was done to them, they're not going to go anywhere with it. They can't go anywhere with it. So even if it's hearsay that the boyfriend is saying he saw this, I'm thinking, again, I'm not the lawyer. You know, that's why, you know, Bob and Eric wind up. And also, Jennifer, you got a much better take on this than I do. But I would think we'd have to see something in her texting or in some digital things or writings from her that's going to have to say exactly what she did, what she felt from him, you know, the stepbrother, and what she reported to the parents. Am I right or no?
No, it's what you're right. And the second, the third point you make on that is the most important. Was she begging not to be around him? Was she telling them that he's, you know, going after her sexually? And I just don't think, judging from what the prosecution's documents say so far, that's the picture we're getting.
Right, because they're using the word modifiers. If they thought they had the things that made her more clear to the parents, it would be a lot more precise.
It's going to be fascinating to see where this all, and extremely sad where this all falls out. But again, another case that gets worse by the moment. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in and give us your thoughts. Jennifer Coffendaffer, Break the Case with Jennifer Coffendaffer. Check it out wherever you get podcasts and on YouTube. Go and press subscribe right there. Robin's latest book, It's Not All About Me, available wherever books are sold. Highly recommended. Go and check it out this weekend or wherever you are watching this. All right. It's going to wrap it up for today. Until next time, for Jennifer, for Robin, for Todd, I'm Tony Bursky. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
The person accused of killing Anna Kempner is working a landscaping job right now, by the way, in case you were playing along at home with this. That is where this case stands. A 16-year-old facing first-degree murder and aggravated abuse charges in federal court, accused of killing and SAing his own stepsister aboard a Carnival cruise ship. And his pretrial release conditions were recently amended to allow him to leave his uncle's home and work at his biological father's landscaping business. He wears a GPS ankle monitor. He's supervised by an adult. When he leaves the house, he lives with a relative in Hernando County, Florida. And according to his own defense attorneys, in a filing submitted to the court, he has complied with every condition that was set for him. Anna Kempner's body was found under a bed aboard the Carnival Horizon, wrapped in a blanket, concealed beneath life jackets. Not exactly accident, if you're, reading the tea leaves. The Miami-Dade medical examiner ruled her death a homicide by medical asphyxiation. Her airway was physically blocked. Reporting on the investigation described bruising on her neck consistent with an arm held across. She was 18 years old. She was a high school cheerleader in Titusville, Florida. She planned to join the Navy after graduation. And according to multiple people who knew her, she did not want to go on that cruise. She told people she reportedly didn't want to be on that ship. And now the person accused of killing her in a log cabin aboard that ship is entering a not guilty plea in federal court. Not in person, not standing before a judge, but through a one-page document filed by his attorney. He signed it and waived his right to appear at the arraignment. One page. That's what that moment looked like. On a piece of paper submitted from a distance while the family of the girl found dead under a bed waits for a system that still hasn't decided whether the accused should even be in custody. And it's all part of the same system because her family is his family. At least by marriage now. Anna's father, Christopher Kempner, has not been quiet about where any of this stands. He told reporters he wants to see the accused in an orange jumpsuit. He called him a danger to the public. He said the family is placing trust in the justice system, but that they are deeply troubled, that despite the seriousness of the charges, the accused has not been taken into custody. That's the victim's father speaking. He's also the accused stepfather. He married Timothy Hudson's mother, Chantel, in December of 2024, less than a year before the cruise that was supposed to bring the newly blended family together. Anna shared a cabin on that ship with Timothy and her 14-year-old half-brother. According to Anna's ex-boyfriend, that younger brother heard yelling and violent sounds coming from inside the locked stateroom the night before Anna's body was discovered. Ship surveillance reportedly showed one person entering and exiting the cabin. The warning signs didn't start on the ship. The ex-boyfriend's father alleged to Inside Edition that the accused was fixated on Anna, that he was infatuated with her, that he always wanted to date her despite being always her stepbrother. And that he always carried a large knife, too. During a FaceTime call, according to the ex-boyfriend's account, the ex-boyfriend watched the accused come into Anna's room while she was sleeping and climb on top of her. He said he tried to warn Anna's parents, and according to him, they didn't believe it. That was before the cruise, before the cabin, before any of this. Someone raised a flag, and the people in a position to act on it reportedly said, "Nah." After Anna's death, the family's response became its own story. Her obituary was edited after it was published. The stepfather's name was removed. A reference to her father's second wife, Tabitha Kempner, was taken out entirely. The current version lists Anna's biological mother as Heather Wright. A reference to the Donahue family was also removed. The people closest to Anna were rewriting the public record in real time, even in the death announcement. That tells you something about how this family was processing what happened, or how they wanted the public to see it anyway. For months, almost everything the public learned about this case came not from the FBI, which refused to comment on an active investigation, but from a custody battle between Timothy's mother and his biological father, Thomas Hudson. Those family court filings became the only window into what happened on board that ship. Through them, the public learned that Timothy had been identified as a suspect, that he was on medication for ADHD and insomnia, and reportedly hadn't taken his insomnia medication for two nights on the cruise. That, after the ship returned to Miami, he was transferred to a medical facility, and that, in text messages between his parents, his mother wrote that he kept repeating he couldn't remember anything. The custody dispute has created its own collateral damage. Thomas Hudson, the accused biological father, has filed for sole custody of the accused 9-year-old sister, arguing that he should not be living in a household connected to these allegations. That means the accused's own father is using the case to reshape the custody arrangement. Meanwhile, Christopher Kempner, Anna's father, who is also Timothy's stepfather, is caught in an impossible situation. He lost his daughter. The person charged with killing her is his wife's son, and he is publicly calling for that person to be locked up while still, by law, connected to the family that produced him. That blended family that was supposed to come together on that cruise is fractured along every possible line. He can't remember anything. But someone wrapped Anna's body in a blanket. Someone placed her under a bed. Someone covered her with life jackets. It's not a scene that happens by accident or in a blackout. The alleged concealment of Anna's body suggests awareness of what occurred and a deliberate effort to delay discovery. Those two realities, the claim of no memory and the physical evidence of calculated concealment, are going to sit at the center of whatever happens at a trial. Federal prosecutors filed sealed charges in February under the Juvenile Delinquency Act. Timothy surrendered at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Miami, appeared before Magistrate Judge Edwin Torres, and pled not guilty. Prosecutors argued he was a danger and should be detained. The judge, he disagreed, released him to family members without bond and set conditions. He walked out of a federal courthouse, accused of murdering his stepsister, and went to live with his uncle. Then the defense made a move that nobody expected. Unsealed court records show that on February 23rd, Timothy Hudson, with the advice of his three federal public defenders, signed a written waiver requesting to be prosecuted as an adult, not accepting the transfer, requesting it. He waived his right to a hearing. He waived his right to appeal. His attorneys co-signed. A 16-year-old voluntarily asked to be moved into a system where the maximum penalty is life in federal prison. Whatever the defense is building, they believe it works better than adult court. That's a calculated beat, and it's one the public is only beginning to understand. A federal grand jury returned a superseding indictment on March 10th, two counts, first-degree murder, alleging both premeditated killing and killing during the commission of an aggravated SA. An aggravated SA itself, alleging the accused used physical force. The indictment was formally unsealed on April 10th when the case transferred to adult court. For the first time, the public saw what the government had been constructing behind sealed doors for months. 3 days after the unsealing, the U.S. Attorney's Office announced the indictment and simultaneously filed a motion to revoke Hudson's release. The government's position is that the juvenile release order no longer holds because this is now an adult prosecution under the Federal Bail Reform Act. They want him detained. They want him locked up before trial. They already lost this argument once in that February hearing. They're asking the court to try again. The defense isn't backing down. They filed a response arguing compliance with every condition, GPS monitoring, adult supervision, no unsupervised contact with minors. And they made one very specific ask: send the detention rehearing back to Magistrate Judge Torres, the same judge who heard the February evidence, the same judge who released him. The defense wants the referee who already ruled in their favor making that call again. That's not random, that strategy. And while the two sides fight over whether the accused should be free, the prosecution has quietly turned over its entire evidence file. The complete medical examiner's report, which the ME's office has refused to release publicly. Body cam footage from the federal authorities boarded the ship at Port Miami, and a cell phone data extraction from a phone identified in court documents only as belonging to CK. Prosecutors haven't publicly identified who that is. Anna's father is Christopher Kempner, though. CK. If the government pulled data from the victim's father's phone and handed it to the defense as discovery, that tells you the investigation didn't stop at the cabin door. It reached into the family itself. What's on that phone and why the government considered it relevant enough to extract and disclose? Those are questions that don't have public answers yet. Now, consider the trial itself. Prosecutors have estimated it would take approximately 7 days. That's it. 7 days for first-degree murder and aggravated SA aboard a cruise ship in international waters. That's a government that believes its physical evidence tells a tight, contained story. Surveillance footage, medical findings, the state of the cabin, what was found, where, and how is, and how it was concealed. If the prosecution thinks a week is enough to present its case, the question isn't whether they have evidence, it's what's in that file that makes them that certain. And if the defense reviewed the same file and still entered a not guilty plea, they believe there's something in there that they can find. The Speedy Trial Act gives government 70 days from indictment to bring the case to trial, unless the defense waives that clock. In practice, federal defense teams almost always request continuances. The timeline from here is uncertain, but what's not uncertain is that a detention hearing is coming. A judge is going to have to decide whether the accused stays free or goes into custody while the case moves forward. And if that judge orders detention, nobody has publicly addressed the question that sits underneath all of it. Where does a 16-year-old prosecuted as an adult in federal court actually go? It doesn't fit cleanly into juvenile facilities under adult prosecution. Putting a minor in an adult federal detention center raises its own set of legal and safety concerns. The system that's protecting this case doesn't have an obvious place to hold the person at the center of it. That's not a footnote. That's a reflection of how unprecedented this case is and how many questions remain unanswered even as the legal machinery moves forward. Obviously, he's presumed innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. That's a constitutional right, and it holds regardless of what the evidence looks like from the outside. But the distance between not guilty and a not guilty plea filed on paper and anything that resembles accountability for what's happened in that cabin is still measured in hearings that haven't been held, decisions that haven't been made, and a trial date that hasn't been set. The evidence is in. Both sides have it. The plea is entered, and Anna Kempner's family is watching a process grind forward while the person charged with her murder lives under conditions that most people on standard probation would recognize. Anna Kempner was known as Anna Banana. Her obituary described her as bubbly, outgoing, and someone who never had a filter. And that was part of her charm. She sent random I love you messages to the people in her life. She loved the sun and the water and boat days and beach days. She was baptized in May of 2025. She wanted to continue cheerleading at the University of Georgia. She wanted to join the Navy and eventually become a canine police officer. She was months from graduation when she boarded that ship. She had a life mapped out ahead of her, and every piece of it was taken in a locked cabin in the middle of the ocean. None of that brings her back. But whether the system has anything meaningful left to offer her, that answer is still pending. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Love for you to weigh in and give us your feedback. Should he be free working a landscaping job after charges like this? Yeah. We'll continue the conversation there. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Let's go to another case. Anna Kempner, the cruise ship murder. This is another horrible case that appears to be getting worse by the moment. Anna Kempner's stepbrother just pled not guilty to her murder. He is 16, not guilty to the federal charges, he's saying. He's charged with first-degree murder and aggravated SA in a federal courtroom. And right now, he's not behind bars. He's living with a relative, wearing a GPS monitor, and working at a landscaping business. His defense team is arguing he should stay right where he is. It's working out great. The prosecution has turned over their entire evidence file. The defense is making strategic moves to tell you that they are not stalling. They're preparing for a fight. The question is, what kind of fight? Eric Faddis, defense attorney, is with us, along with Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent. Eric, let's dive into this a little bit. When you look at everything this defense team has done so far, requesting the adult transfer themselves, fighting to keep him out of custody, entering the plea without him even being in the room. He wasn't in court during the plea the other day. It was a document they handed over. What are those moves telling you about how they plan to actually try this case and defend their client?
It sounds like they're being very protective of their young client here. They're trying not to expose him to a lot of publicity, to a lot of even to the courtroom process at this point, perhaps because they have something up their sleeve, they believe. My apprehension is there is going to be a specific type of mental health defense here, which I can get into whenever. Yeah. But I think they're teeing this up for restricting access to their clients so that they can mold the narrative in terms of what that defense is going to look like.
Yeah, without him even showing up at court. Let's talk about that, the mental health defense.
Yeah, I'm curious about that, too.
Because it's interesting. They say, he is on ADHD meds. And before everybody's like, I'm on ADHD meds. Yeah, so am I. I get it. It doesn't mean you're going to go be a killer. But this is just part of the case, so we're going to talk about it. Some people get very touchy when I say that. But he was on them. He was also apparently not taking his sleeping medication. We don't know exactly what that was, but apparently he was taking some sort of medication for sleep, and he would not have been taking it the last several nights of the cruise. So those are some factors that could certainly play with mental health. What are your thoughts?
I think the key potentially for defense is going to be that sleeping medication and perhaps a constellation of different medications and the absence of such mm-hmm. medications. If a person, especially a young person, if their young susceptible body is on a number of medications for an extended period of time, they acclimate to those, they adapt mm-hmm. to those, and in some senses they may sort of require those to function normally. When there's a cessation of that medication, especially for a number of days, especially in a completely different environment out on a ship in the middle of the ocean or whatever, could that have physiological consequences for that person? I'm guessing defense is going to argue that the cessation of that medication caused like a fugue state whereby the defendant was basically unconscious but still walking around doing stuff. It's kind of like sleepwalking. I've seen that fugue state defense raised before. I wouldn't be surprised if we see it here.
So how successful have you seen it raised before? Because, and we talked about this as well, when prosecution can bring up this pattern of behavior that was observed by others ahead of time and says, you know, they can literally say, hey, this person is testifying that, hey, this is a pattern of behavior in his life that is irrespective of drugs. And it's not like you're going for not guilty by reason of insanity. It's just he's still culpable for the actions he took. And here's a pattern of behavior, irrespective of being on a boat, irrespective of not taking your meds. Who cares? It's still a pattern of behavior in his life. Is that what you think they'd counter with?
I think that that would be a smart way to undercut such a defense because, you know, the defense is like, hey, this thing that's totally out of the ordinary, totally different from his life, based on a substantial change in circumstances pharmacologically in his life. That's what made him act totally out of character. This is a freak event. But then prosecution comes, it's like, oh, freak event, huh? Let's look at the past. Let's look at the history of ongoing patterns of behavior that seem rather consistent with what the allegations were in terms of the death. So yeah, that would be a way the prosecution would likely undercut such a defense if it is raised.
And that's an interesting thing to try and get the evidence of that, of this being a pattern of behavior. We've learned that several of the family's devices have been examined. One phone handed over, identified coming from CK. Christopher Kempner is Anna's father's name, CK. We don't know if that's him, but that's if we can connect the dots, that might be him. If they're pulling data from the victim's father's phone, I'm assuming they're probably looking at other family members' devices as well. What does that tell you about what exactly they're looking for in this? Is it just to try and figure out what happened here, why they were in this room together at this time, or are they looking for the pattern on those devices of the parents of the father having knowledge of some issues here with the boy, or what might they be looking for in dad's phone?
Tony, all of the above, and look, I mean, families often discuss family issues, and you can do it privately. And with cell phones, it's not uncommon to discuss even sensitive matters. You know, I text my mom about private stuff. That happens within families. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they're probably looking, hey, is there a message from the victim to dad from 2 months before this saying, hey, Stepbro did that thing again. We got to talk about this. This thing keeps happening. Is there a documentation of this pattern that exists, because the evidence of any alleged prior misdeeds can't come from the scene and she's gone. She can't testify about it. So they've got to reconstruct that through this digital footprint if it exists.
And once again, we're having the question of parental culpability come into the case again. I mean, every single case we're seeing with someone under the age of 20 or even in their mid-20s seems to be keep coming back to the same thing.
It kind of reminds me a bit of the Crumblies. It reminds me a bit of, I forget the other families that with like the school shooting type stuff where they're being held accountable. But, and I guess the question is, again, this is just theoretical. I'm not saying it's on dad's phone, but let's say they find a pattern of pleas from Anna to dad or just information to dad from Anna about inappropriate behavior from the stepbrother. And let's say it shows up that dad's not really doing anything about it. It's just like, well, who knows? I mean, whatever it may be. Let's just say there's no action that is taken. Can charges be brought against the dad for something like that, for ignoring the child coming to you repeatedly? I guess it probably depends on the severity of what the complaints are. And should they be, I guess would be the question. I mean, that would be an interesting kind of new precedent to set too. But hey, if we're going to go after bad behavior here, I think let's go after everybody in this crew that's failing each other.
And if I could add one thing on that, Tony, too, for Eric, and that is, in those messages, how explicit would they have to be in order for, you know, like, can it be insinuation? Can you read into it, or do they have to be really, really specific?
You know, I think most of us believe that the parents perhaps have a moral duty when they receive such information to intervene, to protect their children. That's their primary role. And they should do that. But that's not the same as a legal duty. And as a general rule, having knowledge of some horrible stuff in and of itself is not criminal. Now, knowledge plus a direct threat plus inaction, could that lead to criminal charges. I think we're getting closer there. We're talking about, you know, if there was a direct threat saying, hey, you know, Stepbro said he's going to SA me again tomorrow. Please help me, Dad. And believe me, I'm not saying that this text exists. I'm just talking about hypothetical. And the dad looked at that and did nothing. Is that inaction? Could that be seen as having a causal relationship to what happened? You know, I think some prosecutors might get creative under such circumstances and say, hey, we're going to try this. And so, you know, you think about charges like criminally negligent homicide, where if a person is complicit, well, it wouldn't be complicity. But if a person had the knowledge that something horrible was going to happen, like a physical assault, and took no action whatsoever, is there a causal relationship between the ultimate event and their inaction? It's a tough call.
Isn't the connection here the fact, I mean, I know she's 18 when she's dead, but if these things happened prior to her turning 18, again, pure speculation here, wouldn't the connection be the fact that she's under 18, that she can't leave, she's a minor, and it's mom and dad that are ruling the house? And yeah, I mean, wouldn't that, like, you're basically a prisoner to a certain extent when you're a child. You can't leave by law. I mean, it wouldn't that be in itself of you're harboring this environment where someone is coming to you and saying, this person has essayed me or is threatening to, or I feel like he might or whatever. I mean, again, there's so many pieces of conjecture here. But just that in itself, if she's 20 some and he's an adult and they say it to dad and everybody's living at different places, I think slightly a bit different situation. But the fact that they're all under the same roof, they're all minors at the time, again, if this were to all come out, wouldn't that definitely be the responsibility of the parents to take some sort of action there and not just brush it off?
Very possibly. And I think less so under like an involuntary or criminal negligent homicide theory, and more so under a child abuse theory.
Yeah.
Tony, if they are grossly negligent in terms of how they are parenting their kid, and they are knowingly perpetuating an environment that causes a substantial risk to the life or health of the child, that could qualify as child abuse. And there are charges for child abuse resulting in death. Now, there are causation issues that could come up about that, but child abuse resulting in death under such circumstances would not be beyond the pale.
And I feel like we're really flexing your legal brain today, Eric, because here's another angle I'm curious about on the culpability angle. And I want to, for everyone actually tuning in and watching, this is not taken away from the choice these individuals made and how responsible they are for it. No. I'm just curious how about this circle of culpability goes out. So on your conjecture hat, if they are going to use a defense for the son that he was mentally incapacitated or he's on drugs, wasn't getting his right drugs or whatever it is, do the parents then have more of an obligation because he's incapacitated? In other words, are they more culpable because they knew of his behavior and what he's on medication for than if he wasn't?
I think that there is some modicum of legal responsibility for a parent to ensure that a child whom they know is on a meds regimen to make sure that nothing completely out of whack happens. Now, they can't always control that. You know, it's up to the child ultimately whether that child ingests medication or not. But I think the parents need to have a familiarity and a knowledge and an awareness of the pharmacological situation with their child. And if something goes horribly wrong due in part to the parent's negligence with respect to that pharmacological status of the child, there are some arguments, more so on the civil side, that the parents might bear some responsibility.
So many issues we have in our society and world are systemic down to parenting, to bad parenting, to ignorant parenting. And I hope to God, if there is something here in this case that shows this, that shows some sort of pattern of ignorance, of ignoring threats, of ignoring it, that it does get prosecuted. Because this shit just, if we can get to the actual root and then actually start punishing those sort of things before they get somewhere else, and parents are on realizing that they're on notice going forward for this, like we're seeing with the school shooting stuff. Maybe some of this stuff can be prevented and it can't just be brushed away. I saw somebody made a comment. So many parents are very ignorant to when blending families, because you're hell bent sometimes, like, we want to make this work. It's all going to be good. And they get to the joking. It's everything's great. But then sometimes you ignore those dynamics and that it's never going to be perfect. But there is sometimes friction, but then there's threatening behavior too. And I feel like so many parents just, you know, put up the blinders to the threatening, and it's just, oh, it's just uncomfortable. Yeah. It can be far, far worse than that.
This is so much tragically heartbreaking, because in so many of these cases we're covering, these cases, the school shooting cases, so many times, I'd say, I didn't look at the stats as I normally do, but so many times someone, one of the children, whether the victim or even the perpetrators themselves, has reached out for help from parents and gotten nothing.
Forgotten the gun.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Merry Christmas.
Like in the Crumbly case, you know, it's like, at what point is someone going to do something to start mitigating horrendous parents? Because kids know they need help. A lot of kids know they need help. I mean, even the horrendous Koberger knew he was a problem child. And granted, I'm not disparaging shame on the parents, because I think they did a lot with what they had. Could have done more. Obviously, anyone could in the hindsight. But again, he was aware that he had issues. All these people, so many of them know they have issues ahead of time, and yet something fails them, and they make some horrendous choices, and society's left paying the consequences.
So many times. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love to hear from you. Go ahead and drop them there. Robin's new book, go check it out wherever you get books. It's Not All About Me, also available on audiobook if you'd like to listen to it. That's how I like to consume my books. So go and check that out. Eric Faddis, as always, thank you so much for joining us and giving us all of your insights today. Until next time, for all of us, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.